welcome to Comedy with an Accent podcast. I'm your Taiwanese comedian, Quan Wen. I interview comedians who perform English stand-up comedy but who are not native English speakers or they can have a very distinct British regional accent. This podcast is all about comedy, about accent, about languages, and about the comedy technique. So stay tuned if you're interested. Hello, welcome back to Comedy with an Accent podcast. This is still your Taiwanese host, Quan Wen. I've been away for quite a while. This is, feels weird because whether it's a monologue episode or it's an episode where I interview another comedian guest, I haven't done so for quite a few months, so it feels kind of weird, but also therapeutic at the same time to be sitting in front of a microphone and just talk. The frequency of me appearing in the audio podcast world is probably just as frequent as Prince Andrew in public eyes. Well, it's no longer Prince Andrew, it's Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, but that's not the point. The point is I am going to share my 2025 Spotify Unwrapped, I think that's what's called, and some statistics from the hosting platform, and just a little thought on the cultural sensitivity. I'll elaborate a bit further. So if you don't want to hear about the stats, I will note down the time point where you can skip the numbers and just come to the discussion point. First, I'm recording this episode in the awkward period between Christmas and New Year. So a belated happy Christmas, but you may be listening in a New Year's time, and happy New Year first. And I've been thinking about how to call this period. I remember there's like an English, well, maybe like a funny one, thanks to AI located very quickly. It's called Twixmas, or another version is called Twixt with a T at the end, mus. Initially, I thought, what does it have to do with chocolate, the Twix, the chocolate brand? I look it up. Apparently, it comes from an old English word for between. It's called betwixt, B-E-T-W-I-X-T. They sometimes shorten the T, so it's just Twixmas. It looks cuter. It's what they call a portmanteau. And you combine two words to create a new word, you know, words like Brexit or words like brunch. And that's great that when I look it up, because I thought of the word perine, I'm sorry for the pronunciation, is P-E-R-I-N-E-U-M. I need to look up how to pronounce this word again.
Perineum.
And I thought, is that the word? And I look it up, no. Is the bit between your genital area and your bum hole. So I guess the idea is that there's all really awkward part of your body. So just like this awkward part of the time, you never know what day it is and you're still, not me personally, because I don't cook turkey, but I think for English people, it's just endless. Oh, pardon me, British people, just endless turkey leftover and turkey sandwich. Turkey is so dry. I don't know why you guys eat it. Okay, straight into the statistic. 2025 for this podcast, I've been a lot less diligent. I haven't been very hardworking. So in 2025, I released 12 episodes only. That included 11 episodes in English and one weird leftover episode in French. And that was the episode when I interviewed the French comedian and the promoter organizer of the French language comedy show in London, French It Up. There was a little bit of conversation in French. I wouldn't really recommend the episode. It's just like a funny demonstration that sometimes I can speak half-hearted French, but you don't really need to listen to that one. Excluding the one I'm currently recording, there have been two monologue episodes. There was one episode with one returning guest, and we started a brand new nationality of English-speaking country. There's Ireland, and out of the 12 episodes, we featured two Irish guests. Now, according to Spotify, their podcast reached 63 countries this year, and the top country for listening number is United Kingdom, without any surprise. Number two, funny enough, for Spotify is France. I think that's because I released the bilingual comedian Tati McLeod's episode in January. As a result, there's a fair bit of people in France wanted to know more about Tati, but I didn't retain all of them. I'll explain later. And the third country is United States. Number four is my home country, Taiwan. And number five is Germany. This is no surprise there. The other funny thing is Spotify then combine the listeners and sort of report their activity. So people who listen to the podcast, their favorite, so the singer they like the most, number one is Taylor Swift. I think it shows that I definitely have more more reach to young women and gay men. Number two is Bad Bunny. That's cool. I don't listen to a lot of hip hop or rap music. I don't know what Bad Bunny's actual genre is, but I think it's super cute. Number three is Lady Gaga. Number four is Olivia Dean, which I don't know of. And number five, I found it absolutely hilarious. So people who listen to the podcast, their favorite artist, not singer in this case, number five is Johann Sebastian Bach. Is I think that is really, really funny. Other thing that surprised me, the top other podcast show that people listen to this podcast also listen to turn out to be Joe Rogan Experience. I mean, I know that is one of the most popular podcasts on this entire planet, but I don't really think there's much overlap. The only possible explanation, I mean, no shit. No, I'm just going to say, I personally don't like Joe Rogan. I think he gets really good guests, but he just wobbles on forever a bit too long. But the number two podcast that people listen to this podcast also listen to is The Rest History. Now, you can say I hold prejudice against certain people, but I just don't think between Joe Rogan and Rest is History, there's a lot of overlap. I think it must be two very different kind of demographic that consume these two podcasts separately. Or I may be wrong. If you happen to be one of those people who listen to The Rest of History and Joe Rogan Experience at the same time, then if you like to combine historical knowledge with some little touch of toxic masculinity, do let me know. I personally think that's because one of my guests this year is Mike Wright, who is a phenomenal, brilliant comedian. But I do have to say, because of Mike's podcast with Vittorio, there is a very big demographic of what we call lads, kind of dudes that follow them. So I noticed after I uploaded the episode with Mike, when I checked the kind of podcast other people also listen to, it used to be very specifically something cross-cultural, but after the Mike Rice episode, it has been more of those lads comedy podcasts. I don't want to disparage it, but I think it's just my personal observation. One thing I do like to point out, though, is that Spotify only represent about a third of overall podcast listening number. Based on my platform, 42.4% come from Apple Podcasts. So even though not everyone has an iPhone or whatever, MacBook, the Apple system, Apple Podcast represents still the largest chunk of listening source. So 42.4% from Apple Podcasts and 35.3% from Spotify. I just talked to you about the top country, and that's all Spotify only for the whole year. Now, based on my own platform, I was able to look at the whole year right now, but I have to pay for the premium subscription, which as a thrifty Asian person, I refuse to. So I'm going to tell you on that platform. So this is across Spotify and Apple and Chrome, all the other listening method, listening channels. Overall, the top country that listened to this podcast for the last 6 months, if you want the result from January to June, the first 180 days of the year, I think was Monologue 2. There was one episode that covers it. From July to December, the top country is UK, that is 25.47%. Number two is USA, that is 16.19%. Number three is my home country, Taiwan, that's at 10.91%, roughly 11. Number four is Australia. I think some Australian people discover this podcast late. It's at 6.24%. Number five is Germany at 5.54%. The rest of them is Japan, Spain, France, Netherlands, and India that complete the top 10. So the top three have never changed much, but I think Australia represent the new growth of this podcast. So welcome. The top city is a funny case. So number one is still London. And number two is my home city, Taipei, this time. It's because I was back in Taiwan and I released a little clip, a reel in Mandarin, and that one went mini viral in Taiwan. It's about Taiwanese political party satire. Because of that, lots of Taiwanese people discover me, I guess, and then by extension, they discover this podcast. Actually, based on the individual number, Taipei looks like the highest. But my platform divided London into little boroughs, so I have to add out different number. And in the past, it was always really obvious that London is the top city. This time, both top is Taipei and New Taipei City, which is like the region surrounding Taipei. So I have to add up all the London boroughs going down all the way to top 50 to make sure, oh, okay, London still edged Taipei down to the second. So you can see London being divided into Westminster or Fulham, Lewisham and Suther, different boroughs. Number three is Sydney, also from Australia. Number four is Berlin. Number five is Melbourne, so two biggest Australian cities. Number six is Glasgow in Scotland. Number seven is Ashburn. This is what I suspect, the evil data center in the US. Number eight is Colombo in Sri Lanka. I think that's because of our previous guest, Vidura. And Vidura has been releasing specials and going on tour, so more people have discovered Vidura and probably by extension then found the old podcast episode recorded within 2023. Number nine is Amsterdam and number 10, Singapore. That's all the statistics I have for you. Why did I release a lot fewer episodes? Not less. This grammar is very important in English. I don't know. I've been a bit burnt out, and instead of just like quitting it or just say like, okay, I'm going to have a big break and launch season three, I feel if I say I'm going to stop season two and launch season three, the once season three started, I have to come back to the twice weekly upload. I don't know if I can cope with that. So I don't know. I just feel like there's enough episode in the catalog, and if people do discover it, but I'm not updating it very regularly, then you can go back to a lot of old episodes. For the people that have been following this podcast, I am sorry. I'll try to upload a bit more frequently in 2026, but I don't have like an iron 100% promise. This is the best I can do without fully quitting. I think the podcast is a brilliant idea. There'll probably be more monologue episodes in 2026, just because I still say that it's not the same amount of guests that are still available. I do have about 4 to 5 episodes already recorded, not yet edited. So there is some cushion. I have some inventory. We'll see. Now, away from the statistic, I want to talk about something that's quite, it's about cross-cultural understanding. I was listening to a podcast from Taiwan in Mandarin, and that podcast is talking about international career, but career more in the sense of those in an office job, like very corporate. One of the hosts is what they call the international career coach. In general, maybe because I do comedy and I used to be in the corporate world, I'm always a bit cynical and I like to make fun of people who call themselves international coach, because when I grew up in Taiwan, it's such a thing that we look down on ourselves. We think Taiwan is so small and anyone who has an international career should be admired and should be so proud of themselves. That create this sort of very unhealthy environment. But I think this coach has quite a healthy attitude, unlike some people who put on a bit of facade and going by to say that you pathetic loser, unlike me, I'm the successful person who succeed in an international environment. Okay, sorry, this is not the key point. The key point is this podcast normally talk about how people from Taiwan can succeed in the international corporate environment. And they were discussing one topic that is an overlap with this podcast. There was one reader's comment who mentioned that working in an American company, the American colleagues mocked that person. Basically, that person's accent became the target of a joke. People say that, oh, it is so cute how you pronounce a certain name. The pronunciation is wrong. And then they talk about just how accurate, is there even an idea that your pronunciation is wrong? So they talk about the subject of accent in an international corporate setting. One of the hosts, being an international career or workplace coach, mentioned the subject of cross-cultural intelligence. The Mandarin term she used was 跨文化情商. She then mentioned there was some study and there are 6 stages of how a person will move from cultural understanding. So when I Googled, I found that the source material was quite specific. It was from an American sociologist called Milton Bennett. He developed what people call colloquially a Bennett scale, but the full name is Developmental Model of Intercultural Sensitivity. So this is more like an understanding of how cultural sensitivity works, how one person is aware of different cultures, also different cultural worldviews and surroundings. a continuum. They are too extreme, and people sort of fall between these two extreme at sort of six stages. I will then say I didn't actually find the source book, so this is just a quick Google. I found the idea on Wikipedia compared to the Mandarin interpretation from this Mandarin podcast I listened to. But I do find this very interesting, and it provides a good framework of how we can, I don't know, I'm not fully sure how to use this, but it's a really good launch point for cross-cultural understanding, and it comes back to the motto of this podcast. So according to, I'm actually not sure whether Milton Bennett is a doctor, but if he's a professor, he probably should be a doctor. So I'm going to say Dr. Milton Bennett. Stage one is denial. You deny there's any, I don't know whether you say you deny there's any cultural differences or you deny the importance of cultural differences. So basically a person in denial, his worldview is just his own culture, and his own culture is the only thing that makes sense. No cultural differences, only his own culture as the real one. The second stage is a bit different. It's called defense. At this point, you kind of acknowledge, but here you say it's acknowledge. It's just not acceptance. You do acknowledge, yes, there may be cultural differences, but you treat all the other culture as inferior. So only your culture is the true culture. So you say, yes, there are other culture, but my culture is the best. So everyone should surely understand the world through my culture. That's the second stage. The first stage is called minimization. So at this stage, you will say, yes, you recognize there are cultural differences, but what you tend to agree or recognize are quite superficial. Typically, it will make references to food or very obvious stuff. You still try to emphasize the universality. You look at the physical structure of things, and you say that there's a universal value. You say that, yes, there are cultural differences, but these cultural differences do not matter that much. And this scale divided the six stages into two groups. So the first three I mentioned, they are still at the ethnocentrism stage. It's only the last three get to a more sort of mutual understanding called the ethno-relativism. But people in the minimization stage are most likely to think they are the do-gooders. They are the good people. They think that, yes, I do acknowledge your cultural difference, but surely it's not as important as something else, blah, blah, blah. So they seem to be supportive, but effectively, in real terms, they are minimizing you. I think this is a big example of a moderate Republican in the USA or a moderate Tory. So in some cases, I think of some people, not all, but like the venue Soho Theatre in London, some people go there, but they go there for tokenism reasons. So they want to watch certain show from diverse background. So they want to do the superficial work of ticking a box to say that, see, among the shows I watch, there are enough foreign people, there are enough people from ethnic minority background. But deep down, are they really that interested in other cultures and minority cultures? No, they just want to be seen. They just want to be perceived to be one of those open-minded person, but they're actually not that open-minded. So I found this absolutely fascinating, this scale. Now, let's move on to the fourth. The fourth is acceptance. That means that people really do accept that there's cultural differences and they can have positive curiosity. They would like to be informed. They would like to learn more about other cultures, but they stop short of taking real actions. So an example would be, I'd like to know about other cultures, but do I want to really put in effort learning another language? No, that is not enough time for that. So this is my interpretation of the fourth stage. The fifth stage is called adaptation. People expand their worldviews. They will be able to behave in a variety of culturally appropriate ways. In this case, a multicultural participant, they start to develop intercultural communication skills. You will even, according to different people you talk to, change your communication styles. And number six is what they call integration, that everyone at this position will have a definition of a self that's marginal to any particular culture. So at the integration state, when you learn about, when you interact, when you know about another culture, your original setting, original worldview will not have, I don't know how to put this correctly, yourself isn't that important or that be when you start to see something different. You just throw yourself into, I don't know, I'm not doing this justice, but you can see it is a continuum. It is a spectrum from this absolute ignorance of a denial, defense of cultural differences to a bit more positive, sort of not just acknowledging, but actually embrace the cultural differences. And I think most people are somewhere between the two. I would say quite a few are at the absolute extreme, but if you listen to the difference, you probably have a good idea. So, maybe I'm not as progressive as I think. I sometimes say I want to learn about other culture, but I wholeheartedly agree with their value of way of doing things. I wouldn't say so. So I don't think I'm at the integration phase either. And a couple of funny things I like to throw out, and I think that's really important to this discussion. You can be a comedian that gets to the acceptance or adaptation stage, but then you are a performer. And what happens when you realize that your audience of a given room, a specific room you have, they are not at the same stage as you. If you only suck up to them, don't you sort of minimize your own culture in a way? So choosing what group to perform to also becomes a choice. And I think I implicitly talk about this in my past recordings and past interview with other guests. In a country that you are in, the host country, there will be people at different stage. And depending on how a show is run, the reputation of the show, the percentage of diverse act they seek, it will create a different brand. And because that brand, you kind of have a vague idea where they are at. So I guess the six stages made me think back how I operate being a comedy performer in the UK, because I started doing comedy after being an immigrant in this country for at least over a decade. I kind of knew what British people like, but I also kind of know what they like, but I don't really like. For example, puns. In the joke repertoire, puns is not something that excites me, but I know that British people, a lot of them really, really love it, and it's a very effective tool. I will come to terms with it and sometimes employ it, but it's not a significant portion of my jokes. Maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because I don't think I can do it well, or I don't know. Maybe I don't even think I can do it well or not is a question I need to answer. I just don't like them. I don't find them funny when I come up with one. I don't find it rewarding, but just having some of them sometimes sort of diversify the genre or style of jokes I have. So I will occasionally do them, but it's never a thing that excites me. Sometimes I also realize that as a foreign act, painting my own culture or painting foreigner as absolute idiots or just correspond to the exact negative stereotype that British audience, some of them may have. It's a very effective tool, but I feel in doing so, I sort of regress into a more primitive stage than I don't want to. I want to succeed. I want to entertain people, but I don't want to do it at whatever cost. I think there's still a minimum that I have to hold. I need to draw a red line and say, this is other thing I refuse to do. But in the area you will be able to accept and happy to come to a compromise. Because I think that when I accept the cultural differences, I know your way of doing things. It doesn't mean that I ditch completely my own culture and myself. If I move away from comedy and just give you a really random example, I remember maybe it was New Year in a setting of a group of friends and we were toasting. French people say ching ching and English people say cheers. I toast, but then I didn't look someone else right in the eyes. And I think in multiple cultures, that is crucial. That is politeness. When you toast with someone else, then you're supposed to look them in the eyes. So I was then corrected by the French boyfriend of my friend because I wasn't really looking other people in their eyes. And he corrected all of us, all the Taiwanese people at the table and say that you need to look us in the eye. Otherwise, it is rude. So we obliged. But later, I was a little bit unhappy about it because I had no intention of being rude. And you can say, I didn't know that's your way of doing things. But back in Taiwan, when you toast people, we tend to sort of look people around, but we don't really focus on absolutely locking eyes. And why is locking eyes that important to them? Okay, it's their culture. But why did I not want to do that? Because looking people in the eye is too direct, too straightforward. It's considered, maybe outside the toasting scenario, it can be considered rude. And quite often we don't look people always in the eye. That looks too audacious. So we are trained culturally to be less confrontational, so to speak. So was a knee-jerk reaction to how my cultural setting, how it normally would be. I think at that time I told myself, oh my God, I was so rude. I should have done exactly what he said without he having to correct us. Now I would think, no, I was supposed to understand how his culture works, but he also has an equal obligation in a cross-cultural setting to understand where I might have come from, not passing on judgment right away. In that case, if he had known in the East Asian culture, our politeness means try not to look people audaciously straight into their eye. It's something that's also important. He may make assumption that, oh, maybe that's why, without giving that accusation kind of tone to say that, is it because? And that should lead to a discussion, and then we agree on our midpoint. You know, this is the way when we are together, this is the way we do things going forward, specific to you and specific to me. Instead of that, he immediately passed on the judgment. This is the way to do things. You apparently didn't get it. In hindsight, that was a bit rude. I mean, obviously, there's friendship, so we can get past it. But I think that was a good example of different people having different reaction in a cross-cultural setting, because our worldviews, our way of doing things are all different. So we should come to like a common ground and sort of middle place. And that is, bring this back to comedy. Let's just focus on the accents. So having an accent, should a foreign comic worry about their own accent, and do they have to work on it? And it's always a very difficult question for me, because quite often I say that accent should be embraced, but also you want to make yourself understandable. So where is the middle point? It's very, very hard to say. I used to be a grammar Nazi, so I also used to be a pronunciation Nazi. But then having moved to the UK, I realized that the perfection I was looking for, I would never achieve it. I didn't start speaking and learning English at a young enough age. I will always speak with an accent. And some people explain this really, really well. They say that when we are just a baby, when we were a clean slate, our brain, our muscle, our organs were, there was no default setting. So our brain and our speech muscle could do everything. But then to make things process further, they would sort of pre-groom in something, and then they would do some function that seemed unnecessary. For example, in the English language, a lot of people is not able to pronounce the sound U. U exists still though in French and German. So when you see English speaking people learning French and German, quite often they wouldn't be able to pronounce the sound U. It's not because the human are not able to do so. It's because when you grow up speaking English as your first language, then the ability to detect the sound and the ability to make the sound is deemed irrelevant when you are an English speaker. So gradually you lose the ability to do it very easily. If you still want to, if you really put an effort, you may be able to, but it just doesn't come as natural as easily. When your native language is set to a certain language, then you are more likely to do certain things, but there are things that are just much more difficult when you try to do it when you're an adult. And that is to say that because of your mother tongue is said to be A, whatever other language you speak, you are likely to carry an accent because of the setting of the language A, your mother tongue that you speak. Then I thought, wow, it would never be possible then. So where do I draw the line? I was talking to another Taiwanese friend the other day. In the middle of the sentence, he said the word rivalry. Then I realized that he was trying to say rivalry. Then I thought, ooh, like 10 years ago, I probably would have mentioned it. I would have said, you pronounce it wrong, as rivalry. Then I thought, should I? I didn't. But then I really, really overthought. I was like, am I doing him a disservice? Should I have pointed out? Because that's not the right way of doing it. But then I thought, yeah, I was able to understand him without the absolute correct sound. Could he be considered an accent thing? But actually, a lot of people from Taiwan wouldn't pronounce rivalry as rivalry. It may be a personal thing. I don't know how many other people would be able to work it out based on the context. But was it my place to point out an error in his pronunciation without him asking for it? All the different angles got mixed up. I still don't have the correct answer. This is what I think every day as someone who lives in an English-speaking country and perform to predominantly English-speaking audience. Like, is my accent too strong? Should I be ashamed of my accent? I shouldn't. But just how clear is my accent? do I have to worry about having too much British pronunciation or American pronunciation? I don't know. I don't have all the answer to that. But whether the audience embrace me and my accent is also back to this continuum, the six stages of cultural sensitivity. I would love the audience to have a certain understanding. If they do think that when I perform there's a bit of accent, I would like them to celebrate that, because if they want an accent-free performance, it's not theoretically, it's just practically, I cannot do it. I will always speak English with a little bit of influence from my mother tongue. So that's just not possible. Rather than they just put up with it or they accept it, I would like them to think that actually that add bit of flavor, I sort of enrich the otherwise monotonous tone of a comedy night, because someone's quite different, is performing with different angle, different perspective, also with different accent. But I don't want them, or I don't need them to be loving me just because I speak English differently with a different accent. I don't want them to be the reason I like it. I still want them to think that they like me because the jokes are funny. Also the jokes I create, AI compose, carry a different worldview. I didn't fully explore the six stages clearly or in an analytical way, but I hope I can come back to them and use them as a discussion point in a future episode, or maybe in a couple of future episodes. There was one theme I'd like to explore recently as a monologue. It's a general phenomenon. A good portion of the population has thrown their support behind extreme right. Now, the term extreme right may be a bit contentious. Some people think that it's like alternative voices because the mainstream party failed and so late like the voice to be heard. But at least for me personally, the one with their support surging in the UK Reform Party has been led by an egotistic politician, Nigel Farage, and a lot of their tone on the discussion on race, I would personally qualify the extreme right. Okay, we all have different political beliefs, so this is not the key point I want to dwell on. I wanted to say that just about 2 months ago, there was a political rally held by an extreme right figure, Tony Robinson, in the UK. And lots of people show up for their support because they are fed up with mainstream politicians. A lot of people went there just to voice their grievance. And they state when they were interviewed by the media that they didn't want to throw support 100% behind Tony Robinson. They don't 100% agree with whatever he stood for. But they thought it was a brave opportunity to let the current government in the UK know that they are not happy. But so many people went and it broke certain taboo, and suddenly sort of very tense racial driven language become possible. Sorry, this has been long as a setting. What I noticed after the rally is that when I went outside London to certain city, I'm not even very rural town, certain city, I was verbally abused on my way to train station. Like, it had happened before, but the frequency of this kind of thing became a lot higher. There are a couple gigs I went to and haven't faced this level of hostility for a very, very long time. It's just like a segment of the audience. And typically they are young men, young white men in their 20s and some in their 30s. They would just cross arm. They call themselves off. So they don't want to engage with me. They give me the impression that the idea of me and the visual of me on stage already offended them, but they could tell that they are still the minority in the whole room. So they have not made like a massive sound. They let the hostility permeate around them. When I perform, I would see them, but I have to ignore that. It's not because they didn't like my joke. They just didn't like the idea of me. And occasionally, you see one or two of them, one of my jokes would break them. He lost control and he would start laughing. But then he became aware that all the people around him, his mates, are not laughing. So he then stopped and turned back to the dead stone face. Ever since that extreme right rally, I've been having more and more this kind of hostile segment of audience. Almost, I don't know, every 1 out of 5 shows. And it didn't happen quite as often as before. So it definitely became more charged. I don't know what offended them. I don't know whether it's the idea that I'm foreign, idea that I don't speak English accent-free, or the idea I'm a homosexual. I don't know. But it has definitely become a thing. And when we talk about this cultural intelligence, it also is the reason why I choose not to go out of London to gig very often. I mean, in the past, I would say as a comic, I want to be able to do every room. But when someone tells me that, well, you are not funny, you're just not funny. Ultimately, it's just good joke. It's just comedy. I think that having that kind of idea itself is probably either denials or defense or even minimization. I don't know which of them. Just to say that the starting point is absolutely the same with every people. I say, no, not necessarily. Like sometimes when you face a really racist audience and they hate the fact that the comedian is not white, I mean, how do you negotiate with that? Even if I could, it's not the same starting point though, is it? If when you say that, oh, it's just comedy, there's no difference when you are from a different culture, when you're a foreigner, when you speak a different accent, I don't think that's exactly correct. If I become one of those comedians say that, oh my God, I beat myself up for not being able to entertain a crowd, get me to in like local stages, only because I suck at my job, rather than acknowledging, yeah, but I'm also a bit different. So it was always a bit harder. In the past, I would think of accepting this kind of fact is a failure on my part. No, I don't think so. Especially after the political climate change, I chose not to do certain gigs. I just feel like I'm not going to enjoy this and those people are not going to like me. There was one example in a later show I did. I incorporated a whole routine. So there were different kind of jokes fused in a routine. The main routine was about my experience having acupuncture that's gone wrong. Even though the idea of acupuncture is from a foreign culture, it's very East Asian. A lot of people in the UK, in a big city, they have a vague idea of it. They may not be crazy about it, but as soon as they started listening, they realized a lot of jokes, actually they are jokes based on pun, they are visual jokes, they are sort of dirty sex jokes. A lot of things had nothing to do with acupuncture per se, but it's about all the little things that happened when I was on the way to do the acupuncture. That routine always, always worked. If not killing, it would at least have a decent reception. But those are the only ones I went to a comedy show in Liverpool. Even though the show was in Liverpool, sort of city center, the majority of the crowd had a rural vibe. And then I realized a lot of them come from the little villages or maybe suburb of Liverpool, and they come into the city to celebrate over the weekend. So they have a less sort of metropolitan, cosmopolitan mentality. When I mentioned acupuncture, the whole room switched off. And I have to say it's because they lost interest. Because their worldview is very simple. I think they are either at the denial or the defense or cultural difference stage. Like I say, they don't really care about anything outside there. So what they wanted to hear is something quintessentially British to them. So they want to talk about, I don't know, getting drunk. They want to talk about football, but maybe they want something more universal, you know, on the difference between men and women, on shopping and dating, I don't know. But as soon as they heard the word acupuncture, half of them switched off. And when I tried to explain what that is about, more people switched off. And the horrible thing is that routine lasted for at least 10 minutes. And it was one of the most difficult experiences I've ever had. I was scarred. Did I still do the routine after that? Of course I did. But I became more wary of choosing where I do it. And sometimes if the crowd sort of seem uninterested in more non-British or like foreign topics, I would actually ditch the original routine. Probably still a reaction to them. But where does it end today? I don't know. Sorry, I'm not quite as organized with my thought because I also realized halfway through recording, my mom just called. And to be able to verify something on my mobile phone, I didn't switch off the phone because I could just see mom on the giant screen. And that is such a trigger point. 2025, and I assume 2026 coming, will still be a very turbulent time. Just reading and watching the news triggered people. I want to admit, and I want to be very frank, I don't think comedy exists in a vacuum. Comedy exists in a segment of the real world that's very complex and there are multiple trigger points. I'm not going to be a purist or like a fighter. I just do whatever I can. And in this little podcast, I hope this is a refuge for someone who may experience cultural shock because you are moving from one culture to another, or you may be a product of different cultures and just trying to find your own place, gaining a foothold somewhere, and want to acknowledge that it's never easy. It is actually quite difficult. And if you've experienced any pain, I feel you. But don't give up. Just find your happy place, because learning from more than one culture is absolutely rewarding. It enriches your life and enriches the life of people around you. You are a seed of positive and very interesting change to yourself and to a lot of people. Embrace that, appreciate it. I'm sorry it comes to such a cringe and kitschy end just because I didn't write a very well-organized analytical structure, but maybe I'll come back to it to do another episode to do it justice. But I think it's a very interesting thing to share with you. Let's make it a future discussion. I don't know. My brain is messed up and I need to call back my mom. Otherwise, she'll be worried. So I'm going to terminate. No, I'm going to end this episode now. Sorry, it's been such a messy episode, but at least you got the stats for 2025 review. I wish you all a very happy new year, and I hope I'll be more diligent and harder working in 2026. So I'll see you very soon. Bye.